guys. Good morning. Great to be with you. Thanks for a great weekend, too. It was a lot of fun. Been with your church. I've been coming to America for a long time now, 25 years, I guess. And I want to say that your church seemed to get effortlessly what I was trying to say in terms of that top button issue of God's heart for others. And I'm not trying to be patronizing or anything, but I'm just letting you know that not everywhere where you talk about that stuff do people get it. And I think sometimes people look at you like, is that it? Did you have nothing deeper to say to us? You didn't even open your Bible, for crying out loud. But I just got the feeling, and I guess it's, you know, the heart of Stovall and the senior team that have caught that, that get that, because being around him and hearing his heart for people and for the lost, I just know it's sort of in the DNA of the culture here. And it's really important, I guess, for me as a visitor to come in and say, like I love people to come and say, first-time visitors to us, what did you think? And I think touching that heart, that commitment, that value to grow and to reach beyond ourselves, I never take that for granted. Like I said on Sunday, I think if a church is unusual, it's unusual because someone's decided we will not be usual. And the more people that decide we will not be usual, then the more we keep the usual at bay and we build something unusual. And God knows this country needs unusual churches. There's so much that's the same, sounds the same, looks the same, dresses the same, talks the same. I can close my eyes with most preachers that I hear coming out of America and tell you exactly what's coming next. From the moment they open their mouth, I can tell you where we're going. I get it. No surprises there. And you know, that's fine, but it just makes me wonder, is anybody growing? Is anybody learning? Is anybody kind of getting outside the box a little bit? Is anybody wondering, how else do we say even an old thing? Is there a new way to say an old thing? Is there a new way to do church? Is there a new way to do staff? Is there a new way to reach our communities? And so on and so on. And I guess coming from a non-church-going country, I am forced to think these thoughts because we don't have enough Christians in our country to grow our churches from Christians. You know, Christians on tour, those that go from church to church to church, Christians on tour. We just don't have enough Christians on tour that might choose our church this year and swell our numbers. So if we don't reach the lost, we really have no future. And so it's very real for us in England to do church in a way that's relevant, to keep that top button well fastened of our heart for others and God's heart for others. Or we really have no future. You guys are the staff, and we have a considerable staff like you guys do. So we get staff, we understand local church. As I said on the weekend, we've been in the same church now for over 30 years and 26 years full-time, building church, growing people, helping people to reach their potential, and above all, reach out to others. I'm just going to talk a few minutes in this time about the commitment we must make as leaders and as, by definition, staff. Therefore, if we're on staff, we're leading something, to keep growing as people. Maybe the first thing I should say is that growth is not people's default mode. We do not default to growth. We really don't. You know, the most growing people I know have to get up every morning and decide to keep growing. We default usually to laziness. Eventually, we default to inertia. We default to inactivity and stillness and mediocre and average. That's kind of where we default. I have a laptop like some of you do, and my laptop defaults to a mode called sleep when you don't touch it, when you require nothing from it. It defaults to sleep. A lot of people do too. If you don't keep requiring something from you, or others don't keep requiring something from you, I promise you, people default to inactivity and to sleep and to shut down. Then when you touch their life again and demand something from them, they wake up and start responding. But if you don't touch them for a while, and many churches are not touched and not required anything from, so they go into long-term sleep mode over decades. Because nothing's required, nothing's disturbed, nothing unusual is requested from them. And what that laptop can do and its capacity is often never even touched in terms of its potential. And so we do a few simple things on the laptop. We may surf the net and what have you, but the laptop can give you far more than that. Its huge capacity to do more things is never tapped into. And I found that with people, the less you ask from people, the less they will give you. The more you ask from people, the more they will give you, or some of them. And so what we have to do as leaders, or as people, should I say, committed to growing, which I expect that from my staff, we all must commit to grow above the usual, above the average. If we're committed to grow, then we have to be willing to take our lives off the preset factory modes that we didn't choose before we bought the laptop. You know, every mode that's a default mode that's away from growth was preset in our lives, in our upbringing, in our background, even in the culture of our family, the culture of our zip code, the culture of our country, the culture of our environments and backgrounds, the context that we were raised in. Context is a huge, huge shaper of how people think. A lot of people don't realize that about context. Sometimes you ask yourself, why do I do that? Why do I think that? Why do I behave that way? Why do I say that? Why am I defensive? Why am I insecure? Why am I competitive? And the answer is, you don't know why, because no one taught you that. Context taught you, because context isn't a person, and you don't remember saying, yes, context, thank you, context. You don't remember ever agreeing to believe that. But context of churches, context of teams, context of relationships, context of our school upbringing, our family upbringing, context operates by stealth. And context is a teacher, and context is a far more powerful shaper of people than preaching and teaching is. So we have to take charge of the context of our churches. We have to take charge of the context and the environment and the climate of our staff, or we're going to have a double default. We'll default to non-growth because that's what people do. But beyond that, if we have no growth environment we've created on purpose to catch that default and wake it up, there's nothing to stop it, so we default to inactivity, and then there's nothing that we've built in to remind us that we should be growing. So we've had it. So I think this thing that I'm talking to you about, which you may assume, depends when you entered this church. If you've come in more recently, you may just assume, well, everybody just grows here, but that's not true. If people are growing, it's because somebody has thought carefully about what do we need to do to help people to grow. And what do we keep having to do to make sure that we don't relax our effort on that? You're kind of never off this. It's exhausting. You're never off this demand to grow. You can take a day off, take a month off, and you don't have to respond at all. But the potential, the power of what we can produce by committing to keeping growing is massive. And been around church now, as I said, for 3 decades plus, I know that what I just said is true. If people will commit to keep growing, I have been amazed. Maybe I shouldn't have been, but I have been amazed at what comes out of people if they will be in the right context and a right environment. You know, the story of the ugly duckling. Do you know that story? The ugly duckling, Hans Christian Andersen. Well, it's a story about context, because this little duckling is born in this environment, and it comes out of the egg and it sees other ducks and it starts to assume it's a duck, and it behaves like a duck and tries to, but it doesn't fit in, and as it grows it doesn't look like a duck, and the others persecute it, and it doesn't walk like a duck, and it has a different beak, and it looks ugly, and it's persecuted. And long story short, it gets years down the line when it's full grown and it's hiding in the bulrushes by the side of the lake, and it sees these beautiful swans coming towards it. And for some reason, against its better judgment, because it knows better than go out in public, it starts gliding across the pond towards them. As it gets closer and closer towards them, it bows its head down, expecting the usual ridicule that comes at this time. But it doesn't know why it's put itself in this position. And as it looks down for the first time in its life, it sees a perfect reflection of itself in the surface of the lake, and it realizes it's a swan. It's one of them that's swimming towards it. And it realizes for the first time in its life, it was never a duck in the first place. And the story of the ugly duckling is a story of a swan's egg that got into a duck's nest. But the context that it was born in began to make it think it wasn't a swan at all. That's the power of context. And so it's a swan, and its growth and its appearance would have been celebrated in a swan context, but it was not celebrated. It was persecuted. It was odd. It was weird. It was to be suspected and to be resisted in a duck context. And so many of us are swans that have got into a duck context of relationship, environment, context, mindsets, relationships, and we don't know who we are. And a huge part of what we do as leaders and staff and team is to liberate the swan inside people, to let them know that context has taught you that you are something you are not. And so when we speak and when we teach and when we do what we're doing today, you know, there's two preachers in this room today. There's what I am saying to you, but there is what you are saying to you about what I am saying to you. And I've got to tell you, by comparison, I have no chance. Seriously, I don't. So, unless we can get people to align themselves more strongly and more deliberately with what's being taught, then people leave our services all the time, listen to the preaching, nod, take notes, say amen. And I've realized over years of helping people, a nodding head means nothing. It really doesn't. A nodding head means nothing. I've had board meetings and staff meetings. Everybody gets it. Then I hear a week later, somebody's gone around to somewhere in the ministry, and they're completely wrongly representing what we said in the meeting. It's like, were you in the same meeting as me? So now, with my staff, like children, I have them repeat back to me what we all just said. Okay, do you get it? Yeah, I get it. Okay, tell me what you got. because I had this teaching with our church and our staff that was called something like this. Say what you mean, because I'm tired of guessing. To teach everybody to say what they mean, which starts with me first, to say it well so that we all get it, because a lot of stuff is lost in translation, even amongst like-minded, smart people with degrees. We leave the table with all different versions. To grow, you must be teachable. I suppose that's the obvious thing to say, but I've worked with a lot of non-teachable people who teach others. The moment you cease to learn, you forfeit the right to teach. I honestly do. Now, I'm saying that knowing that there's a lot of people teaching who have stopped learning themselves. And I hate that. I think it's wrong, but I'm advocating that we do better than that. I can't think of a better place to sink this thought than Jesus' 3-year relationship with his staff, with his disciples. Because for 3 years, Jesus created a growth environment in which these guys could thrive, and beyond the 12, the extended discipleship team could grow. A growth environment, again, is never by accident. It's always placed there on purpose. But the environment Jesus created is such a good one to learn from, because it was what I would call, you know the condensed soups that you add water to eat, or cordial, you know, the cordial juices you add water to dilute to drink. Because Jesus knew he only had 3 years. These guys didn't know he only had 3 years. He knew he had 3 years to invest in these guys and getting ready for their destiny. They didn't know that, but he did. So it's such a great example of a growth environment, because it is a condensed soup, cordial, strong, neat, undiluted growth environment that Jesus just dropped these guys into. From day one, they're immersed in this fast track towards growing. Him knowing, I don't have 20 years for this. I've got 3, and I've got a lot of work to do on these guys. And the whole gospel is, you know, it's lots of things, but one of the things I've studied quite a bit is his relationship with these guys. And I'm putting it that way, of a cordial or a condensed soup, because honestly, as a leader, trying to calculate the right dilution ratio of how thick or how diluted a growth environment should be is not easy. And I don't think Jesus found it easy either, because, you know, when I stand up and preach to our church, like your teachers and preachers here on Stovall, I've got somebody here that, like this lady that you just mentioned, she was saved on Sunday. Now, she's there next Sunday, okay, but she's sat next to somebody that's been saved 20 years. Well, who do I talk to? How do I grow both at once with whatever I'm going to say? That's part of the difficulty, even on the staff. Where do we pitch it for staff? Where do we pitch how thick the cordial is? Where do we pitch how thick the condensed soup is? Because some of you like your cordial with more water. Some of you like it with less water. Some of you feel that the growth environment is too challenging. It's too demanding. It's too full on sometimes. So maybe you'd like a little bit more dilution. Some feel it's not challenging enough, so you'd like less water added to your church experience. And therein lies the problem of getting it right, calculating right the mix, the strain, the strength of a growth environment. But what I noticed about Jesus, which I learned this after making a lot of mistakes about this, Jesus never asked anybody whether or not they were comfortable with the growth environment he created. He just created it and said, suck it up. Or leave. It took me a long time to learn what I just told you. Because I spent years trying to, I became like a spiritual cocktail mixer. I spent years trying to calculate, how do you like it? You know, can I get it right for you? I want to keep you happy, keep you in the church, keep you on the team. You know, is this too strong? I'm sorry. Maybe me and you can have a little talk, come around for dinner, and, you know, so that I can assure you I understand you, we get it, don't worry, don't freak out. I spent years trying to serve the growth environment, trying to serve up what we were doing just right for everybody, just tailoring it for everybody. And then when I realized that Jesus never did that, he just said, here's the deal, here's the demand, here's what we're doing, and that's it. And many leaders are in trouble because they're trying to calculate the different dilution ratios. And I think what I've learned in more recent years is that growth environments must be purpose and vision driven. They are not people driven. They are not people's needs driven. They are not people's different levels driven. A growth environment, and everybody has one, some have one by default, and so, you know, it's not brilliant and nothing happens on purpose. I'm advocating we have a growth environment on purpose and by design. And you have to decide, you know, as a leadership team here like we do, what will be the marks and the values of your growth environment? What are the things that we'll fight for and die for? What are the things that we're committed to and what are the things we don't really care about? Everybody has to decide them, but the growth environment must be designed on purpose and must be driven by vision and by purpose, not by what the people like and don't like. Because here's the deal. In the church, it's always the people who want to travel the slowest who shout the loudest. So if we try to calculate the dilution ratio, we're always going to add far more water than we should, because those that make the most noise are the ones that think it's too fast and too driven and too committed and too demanding and, you know, too much change going on, and I'm not secure and I just need a little bit of chill time and I don't feel loved in this church. Everything's about purpose. Everything's about reaching people. You know, all this stuff that you get from people that believe church is all about them are the ones that tend to write the letters and shout the loudest and create the most drama. So I uncoupled my soul from those people and decided here, this was 10 years ago now when I've described this crossing over journey that I mentioned briefly at the weekend. Here's the growth environment. Here is our vision. Here is our DNA. Here is our dream. That's it. The dream, the vision, the purpose is a one size fits all. It's non-negotiable. We don't care whether or not you can put that on and wear it or not. Because here's how I describe what I've discovered. So it's a win-win scenario. the vision, the growth environment, the expectation, where we're going, our big idea is a one-size-fits-all. Now, how people respond to it is entirely up to them. How people respond is not a one-size-fits-all. You can respond how you like. You can love it, you can hate it. You can buy into it slowly, you can buy into it all at once. You can have it neat, you can have it on the rocks, you can have it watered down. We don't care what you do with it. That's your responsibility. Our responsibility is to say, here's the dream. That's not negotiable. How you all respond and when and where is completely up to you. We're very cool with that. That's a win-win scenario. I did a message some years ago in our church called Campers, Quitters, and Climbers. Realizing that we've got all three in the church all the time, and sometimes we've got all three on the staff. We've got people that are campers, that are camping on their experience with God. They've defaulted to have been stationary on where they're at with God. They're kind of treading water and hope nobody notices. We've got people that are quitters, that have kind of given up on growing and given up on the vision and given up on investing in themselves, but they kind of hope nobody notices. And we've got climbers that have got summit fever and are just gripped by the big idea and the dream. And all those people are constantly doing life together, and therein lies all the tensions and the dramas that we often get in church life. But I'm letting people know, I know some of you here, I'll say to them often on Sunday morning, I know some of you here are campers and quitters, but I want you to know, I'm not a camper and a quitter. I'm a climber, but I'm cool if you're a quitter today. If you're here and you're a quitter today, we love you. You're still welcome. We'll still have your tithe. You know, you can be a quitter. We'll still use you in the coffee shop. We'll still use you in kids' church. We'll still use you on the welcome team. That's okay. We don't need Mother Teresa to put chairs out. You can be a quitter and still have a role in church life. That's okay. But here's my point. Maybe if you'll keep coming in a growth environment as a quitter, maybe something somewhere will stimulate you, challenge you, and maybe you'll just move today. Maybe you'll take a step today. Maybe this week will be your week to break camp and move on. I don't know. Because the truth is this, many of our climbers now were once campers and quitters. So we don't need to say, well, we only have climbers in this church. No, we don't. We take all kinds in this church. It's not a one-size-fits-all in terms of your response. It's a one-size-fits-all in terms of here's the garment, here's the size it is, here's the dream, bam, and just throw it on people. And some people are smothered in it saying, I'll never wear this, it'll never fit me. Some people feel, that's small, I need something bigger. Cool. But what we have to do like Jesus did, he said, here's the deal, here's the vision, come follow me. And he didn't tidy it up. Explain it, justify it, negotiate, tell them the benefits if they did. He just said, come follow me. That's it. No explanation. Now, environments, let me just say this because this might be helpful for us to appreciate. Environments are not commands. Environments are not mandatory. Environments are invitations and opportunities. That's all they are. If some people don't thrive in a growth environment, it doesn't mean the environment is wrong. It took me a long time to learn that because I used to take it personal when people in the team and in the leadership team and the staff were kind of not thriving in what I'm thinking, well, why wouldn't you thrive in this? And I took it personal. And I would start to mess with the environment and talk about maybe we're not doing this right and doing that right, and maybe this value is not what it should be, and maybe we need to put a little bit of this into the mix. And I'm messing with the DNA, I'm messing with the value, I'm messing with the culture, because I'm not realizing that an environment does not mean people will automatically grow. So you can have the greatest growing environment in the world. And I think being with Jesus 24/7, 3 years, was the greatest growth environment in the world. And if people say, well, if only I was in that church, if I was in that team, if I was on that staff, well, if I had that teaching, well, if I had that leadership, well, if I had those opportunities, well, hang on a minute, how do you explain Judas? Judas is 24/7. In the most incredible growth environment you could ever imagine, but he didn't grow. So a growth environment, once we've created it, does not guarantee everybody will grow. And therefore, I can be free from the responsibility and the pressure of trying to fix everybody's not growing. All I need to know is that the growth environment is good. I think it's right. I think the climate's right. I think the temperature's right. I think the soil is good. I think the seed that we're putting in it is good and thoughtful. I think all of that is good. And therefore, I think, you know, most people should be able to grow in this culture and in this environment. But if they don't, I'm not going to keep changing the culture and the environment. So we have a new vision statement every year. And we kind of mess around with what we were doing last year, and we've changed it a little bit this year because we slowly but imperceptibly keep kind of trying to scoop everybody up into the experience. Proverbs 20 verse 4, a sluggard doesn't plow in season, but at harvest time he still looks for a harvest. There you go, see? In the season that offered the opportunity to grow and required corresponding behavior to cash in on it, this sluggard, because I think that's where we default, this sluggard didn't invest in the season. But here's what Solomon's trying to say in that proverb. Lots of people in a growth environment who don't take advantage of what's provided then still expect to grow and complain when they don't, as if it's the environment's fault. And the truth is that even though it was the season to plow, he did not plow in season. The season didn't plow for him. The season didn't remind him to plow. And a growth environment doesn't care. Seriously, a growth environment doesn't care whether you grow or not. Doesn't care. It's completely neutral. It doesn't care. It simply offers itself, like springtime offers itself to the farm community. And you either sow or you don't, but it doesn't care. It doesn't remind you. It doesn't beg you. It simply says, I'm here. Take advantage. And if you do, you'll have a harvest later in the year. But if you don't, you will not have a harvest. And it's even more stupid to go and expect a harvest when you know you never invested in the season. I know 30 years in the same church, I just got tired of people saying, you know, I never got help in this church. I'm thinking, you never got help in this church. And leave the church after you spent hours and hours and weeks and months trying to help people, trying to save their marriages or help them in their debt situation or in their relational dysfunction or in their attitudes or crises of life, and spending hours and throwing all our resources, and then they leave the church saying there's no love in this church. I think there's something wrong with this picture. I cannot keep doing this. It's going to kill me and age me before my time. I cannot let that let me believe I need to change how we do things because they left after all that input saying it was us that failed them. I used to think that way, and I've changed my thinking. Let me tell you one of the things that helped me. In Luke 13, let me borrow somebody's Bible because my wife's thrown mine in the luggage. Luke 13. Is this a proper Bible here? Is Luke what it normally is? From the motherland. There we go. Is it King James? Is it King James? No. Okay. Last person that spoke King James was King James. So we ought not to be doing it, huh? Still a lot do, but anyway. Speaking King James in 21st century, I'm telling you, anybody reading from the King James in 21st century church is not reaching lost people. Okay, full stop. God help us if you're even... Anyway. Luke 13. All right. Let me think. Where should we read from? Because in my Bible, it's like a bottom right-hand side of the page. Where we are? Verse 6. Let me just read this to you. I never heard anybody teach on this, and it's not a big parable. I suppose it's small, a little bit hidden. But this really helped me in my leadership. When Jesus said, a man planted a fig tree in his garden and came again and again to see if there was any fruit on it, but he was always disappointed. finally said to the gardener, I've waited 3 years and there hasn't been a single fig on this tree. Cut it down. It's taking up space we can use for something else. The gardener answered, give it one more chance, leave it another year, and I'll give it special attention and plenty of fertilizer. If we get figs next year, fine. If not, then I'll cut it down. Okay. This is, God is coming, asking the gardener, this is the picture. In this picture, the owner of the vineyard is God, and the keeper of the vineyard, the gardener, is people. Well, it could be us, it's certainly leadership, it's those that are responsible for the welfare of the plants, or the people, or the nation, or the team, or whatever. But the important thing to know about this scenario is that God is entering this picture as the owner of the vineyard. So God says to the gardener, I've come for 3 years looking for figs on the tree, and it's had none. I am frustrated by this and think by now we should have had figs. Let's pluck this thing up. The gardener begins to debate for a third year running about why there's no fruit, justifying and explaining it and saying, I'll give it another year. So that's 4 years now of non-productivity. I'll go another year with a non-fruitful tree and I'll pamper it some more. I'll dig around it, I'll fertilize it. If after 4 years of no fruit, then maybe then we should talk about plucking it up. I believe one of the reasons why most churches, and it is most churches, are not growing or are not relevant in a 21st century world is because most churches are run by gardeners, not owners. And I've shifted my mentality in the last 10 years from looking at people as a gardener to looking at people as an owner. Because gardeners take it personal when a plant doesn't do well. Gardeners are more pastoral type people, and I'm not saying we don't need gardeners in the team. I just don't think gardeners should be in charge. Gardeners get personally involved and upset and always think it's their fault when a tree, a person, is not thriving. And so they will go another year, they'll go another 5 years, investing in the same person who is producing nothing. Now an owner enters this garden, an owner enters the church world with a completely different mindset. An owner says this, okay, if everything else in the garden is growing, and this one person and one tree is not growing, the problem is not the garden. That's good. That's what an owner thinks. Yeah. This problem is not environmental. Let's not change the environment. Let's not till round. Let's not fertilize. The problem is not the environment, the garden. The problem's not the attention of the gardener, because this tree has more attention than everything else in the garden, which without that attention is all still growing. So an owner mentality says, by now, from this person, we should have had this, 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 and this in terms of productivity. And the issue for God, the issue for the owner was this. He said, pluck it up, watch this line now, because it has no right to use up the soil. So the issue for the owner is this. If I gave another person the same chance in that soil that this person can't thrive in, I think we'd have had a huge harvest now from that person with a fraction of the attention we keep giving this person who's just not growing. And I had no timeout. I had no cutoff with people as a gardener. I would dig around and fertilize another sit down. Another round of attempts to help them. Another throwing my strength and resources at the problem. Only for them to leave saying, I just couldn't grow in that church. Which leaves, you know, over years of people doing that to you and beating on you, you start to feel there's something really wrong with my church. And I'm not saying there isn't something wrong with many churches, but I'm talking about our context here today where we've been more thoughtful about this over the years. And I'm not saying our environment's perfect or what you're doing is perfect. I know that. But what I am saying is we're onto something. We've realized that the response of the people to the environment we've created does not determine the quality of the environment by itself. So if people in our church don't thrive, I'm not changing our church. I'm saying maybe if you're doing church with people all around you that are growing and thriving and you're not, if I have 6 children and feed them all the same food and 5 grow and 1 doesn't, the problem's not the food. You understand? But what we do as gardeners is we don't look at anybody that's growing. We're just infatuated with the one that's not. How can we fix you? How can we help you? How can we fertilize you more? How can we pamper you more? And we put all our resources into non-productive, non-responding people when God's saying, hang on a minute, as an owner, I come looking for the bottom line. You know, when a farmer looks at crops, he does not see crops. He sees dollars. When God looks at people, he doesn't see people. He sees productivity, which we should have by now. So I often say to our team and some of our people in the church, like I said about the lady, I don't know which service I said it in, the lady who's been coming 10 years and said to me, it's not the same anymore when I come to church. And I said to her, do you still come to church for the same reasons you first came? And if you do, that's wrong. You shouldn't be coming anymore as a consumer. You should be coming as a producer and as a giver. And my response to her was unusual compared to what I would have done some years ago when I said to her, hey, you know, come and talk to me more about that. What is it? Why are you not happy? You know, there. Why aren't you getting your blessing anymore? Is what I would have done as a gardener. And so what I did was I took all the gardeners out of the primary leadership of our church and I put owners in charge. Once we got this concept and I said, you know, we need you as a gardener. We need you in what we do. Because sometimes people do need a little bit more attention. You know, we do intensive care in our church, by the way. You know, you might have a terrible impression about church with this teaching I've given. But we do intensive care for people, and we do it really well. We just don't do it long term. Because anybody that is in intensive care long term becomes institutionalized. And they develop a codependent relationship with their carers. And many people are in church because the church has become their new rehab. It's just rehab from life. You know, it helps me cope and helps me get them through another week. And yeah, but you've been a Christian for 15 years, for God's sake. This is not right. This is wrong. And I realized this because people we were reaching, like that were getting saved in our bus ministry. I remember a lady coming one week and she got saved. And I said to her, you're from one of the worst projects in the city. I said, do you think if we gave you a small bus, like a 17-seater, could you bring your family and friends and neighbors? She said, sure. The next week, she came to church and brought 25 non-saved people with her to church. Now, she was difficult to handle. She had no skills. She's not grown as a believer. She's just raw. She's a bit crazy. She's brought 25 unsaved people that are all a bit crazy. And they came into our church. They all sat together. She sat there with them all around her. And I'm getting up and I'm preaching. And I'm going through this transition in the church that I'm describing through the weekend. And on my right is this lady called Sue with 25 first-time visitors she's brought. On my left, you know, is this other couple who've been in our church for 17 years, have never brought anyone. And all they're doing week in, week out is telling me how badly a job I'm doing. And how they can't handle this, and I'm wrong, and this is against what we should be doing, and we can't keep doing this anymore, and can't keep receiving these people, and these people are trashing our church, and these people are using foul language in our church, and smoking cigarettes, they're stealing our stuff, and here you are bringing. And as I'm standing there, it was like a parable itself. It was like the Holy Spirit said to me, okay, son, which would you rather have? Would you rather have this raw, new, barely saved, mixed up, still doesn't know anything lady who's bringing 20 odd people, Or would you rather have this 17-year seasoned, spirit-filled, tongue-talking, charismatic, been in the church years and years and years, knows everything works, who's producing nothing? And it's moments like that that made me get off the bus, that made me rethink how I do church life and lead and the way I talk to our church. And so we can't demand growth from people. We can't punish people for not growing. We can't reward people, I suppose, with any incentive for growing. It's kind of, growth by definition has to be voluntary. When Jesus said, come follow me, that's not a command. Come follow me is not a command. It's an invitation. You respond or you don't respond, and God doesn't care which it is. He'd rather you respond, but if you don't, he's not going to stay next to you convincing you why you should. He's gone. He's gone because there's another one waiting to be reached. And here's the deal with paid staff, okay? And I said this to our paid staff all the time. You are paid to work, but you are not paid to grow. But we need you to grow. And voluntary growth is the most difficult growth to ask people for. You know, a lot of people in church staffs would change, suck it up, and grow, because if they didn't, in the secular world, they'd be fired. We just don't have that leverage in church when we're so volunteer dependent. But voluntary change and voluntary growth is the most difficult to ask for and the most difficult to sustain, and yet we are so dependent on that. But the truth is, if you have a job, which you do and our staff do, or a role or a position of influence or authority in what we do, and you're salaried for that and recognized for that in the church and the ministry, if you have that, but you've stopped growing in that role, a problem's going to emerge. Because if you have a job attached to a growth environment, everything around you will keep growing whilst you're standing still. So eventually, your standstill will show up. Now, you'll still have the same job and the same respect and the same title, but you'll have stopped growing, which won't matter if everything else around you stopped growing. But if everything else around you keeps going forward and you stop growing and gone on hold and gone on pause and gone to default sleep mode, it's going to start showing up.
Right.
Now, here's what happens in the corporate world, but we're talking about church at the moment. When people have a significant staff role and they've stopped growing as a person, but they have people under them that are growing more than them, it creates a real tension.
Yes.
And those that are locked under people that are not growing come to say to me, I just feel, you know, I just feel Steve or Jim or Joe or whatever, it doesn't matter what the name is, but I just feel that I respect them, I love them, but I kind of feel they're not open to a new idea. I kind of feel that they're just on maintenance mode. I kind of feel that they're not passionate about what they do anymore. I don't know. And here's some examples they'll give me of why I feel that. Usually it's not a surprise to me. Usually I've already been hearing that from several others, and I've probably been feeling that myself. And what's happened is that nothing's changed in the role or the title, but that person's began to stop growing as a person. And what happens is we create within the church staff, and it can be again within the volunteers, we create what the Bible calls unequal yoking. We've made unequal yoking, saved, unsaved. But that's the easy way to define it. The more subtle forms are the ones we don't spot, but they're just as unequally yoked and just as damaging. You know, in the Old Testament agricultural laws that God gave them in Leviticus, he said you should never plow with an ox and an ass. Don't ever plow with an ox and an ass. And the reason God said don't put an ox and an ass in the same yoke is because they have different natures. An ox is a docile, servile, submissive creature. It just will pull that plow all day, cause you no trouble. An ass, by temperament, is likely going to buck. It's going to not want to work today. It's going to fight against the yoke. It's going to be temperamental. And God's saying, don't put something that wants to work with something that doesn't want to work. Now, of course, that's not just about animals. No more than the teaching about don't muzzle an ox that's treading the corn wasn't about animals and corn. It was about tithing and honoring those financially that are treading the corn for us spiritually. So this isn't just about animals. So God's saying, don't put people that want to work with people that don't want to work. And my gift to our leadership team and our staff, my gift is to say, hey, let's get the pairings right. Let's not put growing people with non-growing people. One of the adjustments we just made in our staff was we went through the staff and had a huge flow chart, just three of us in the executive leadership, for want of a better term. We're not good on titles, but I'm trying to give you an idea of who these three people were. So we're in this boardroom. Everybody's name on staff is on the board. And we went through all the staff at the turn of this year, about 6 months ago, went through all the staff and tried to define where we believed each one sat under each of these labels. Growers, who are growers, who are managers, and who are maintainers. Because what we had is we had growers locked under maintainers. And we had growers locked under managers. And we had to liberate the growers. I had to come at it with an owner mentality. Who are the people that are growing what we do? And what we realize with is growers are not attached to one area of church life. You can drop a grower anywhere and they'll grow it. So we took the kids' church pastor out of kids' church and we dropped her into our catering department to solve some of our problems, because we have a 300-seater coffee shop and we're about in the new leadership academy we're building that's finished in June that will have a new 100-seater Starbucks, and we're already in problems with the coffee shop we have because it's high volume. In other words, hundreds of people show up at once, all wanting drinks, which is unlike any Starbucks or coffee shop you'll find, where the 300 might come in over several days or a day, but not all at once. And it's caused long lines of people waiting, blah, blah, blah. And this thing became the pain of my life, the coffee shop dramas, week in, week out. And so I said, okay, it needs a grower, a troubleshooter, a fixer, a problem fixer. That's Claire. Claire has solved Kids Church. Kids Church is like clockwork. But Claire is not in Kids Church because she's particularly gifted with kids or particularly drawn to kids. She's a grower. She just fixes things. Okay, let's pick her up and drop her in here and say, Claire, do your thing in the catering. And maybe after 6 months, we're going to pick you up again and say, here, drop you in there. She's a grower. Growers just fix things, grow things, get them off being stuck. They're growers. Who are the growers? And so we identified the growers and we got the growers released from being stuck under people that were maintainers and managers, but they were not growing anything. And it released me from giving a job and giving a responsibility to a manager, because managers carry out what growers and leaders decide we're going to do. They just do it. They're faithful. We need them. They're awesome. But they should not be the first person we give the thing to sort out often, because they're managers. They're systems people. They're not leaders by that definition I'm trying to talk about now when I talk about growers. I don't know how we're doing on time here. Are we okay? I can stop, and if you want Q&A, we can do that too. I don't know. I can go all day here, but we can, you know, 30-odd years in the same church, I got a lot to say. Anyway, I'll say a couple of things, then I'll stop. One of the earliest attempts by the enemy to shut down the momentum of the early church was in Acts 6, when there's a dispute in the church between the Greek-speaking widows and the Hebrew-speaking widows, because the Greek-speaking widows felt they were being shafted. They felt they were not being treated well in the daily distribution of alms and food to the widows. And so this dispute arose inside the church. And the Greek-speaking widows created a huge furor that came to the ears of the apostles. Now, I see the enemy. I don't think the enemy was all involved in that. I think he simply saw an opportunity here. And the opportunity was this. The opportunity he had was to take leaders, the apostles, and change them and change them and turn them into managers. Because the apostles said, we will not neglect the word of God and prayer to sort this out. We will make sure this gets sorted out, but we will not be the ones waiting on tables. That's the mistake a lot of leaders make. A problem arises and they go and fix it themselves. Sometimes because they're control freaks and they want to be involved in everything and are too micromanaging. Sometimes because they have no help and they've got to do it. But often it's the most subtle strategy of slowing down momentum when people that were called to lead get locked into maintenance of problems. And the apostle said, we won't do this, but we'll make sure someone does. And I think we as leaders and growers have to constantly watch that we're not sucked into maintenance and management by a legitimate thing that does need sorting out, but I'm not necessarily the one that needs to be sorting it out. Environments need protecting. Once you've got a growth environment, you have to protect it. When Judas is upset because Mary is wasting the perfume on Jesus, Jesus corrected Judas, not Mary. And he said, Judas, you need to back off because one of the values of my growth environment is generosity. I celebrate generosity. I know you don't because you're stingy and you're stealing, but I celebrate generosity. And she is being generous right now, and I'm very cool with that, but I know you're not. But I'm not letting you shut her down. So what Jesus did was he said, I am protecting my environment around me, and I'm not letting you shut it down. Because here's the deal with a growth environment. And I say this to our church all the time and to our staff. You can be in a growth environment and you can grow. You can be in it and not grow. Both of those things are okay. I'm not talking about staff now where we need you to keep growing, you know, like I described. I'm talking about just in the church generally now. You can be in this church and love it or hate it. That's cool and still come. That's fine. What you can't do is stay in a growth environment and try to stop the rest of us growing. That's what you can't do. So Judas, you can be in this team and not grow because Jesus knew he was in the team and Jesus knew he's not growing. That's okay. But what you can't do, Judas, is you can't try to stop someone else growing. You can't try and shut Mary down. And so growth environments need protecting. And we as the leadership team and the staff, I hope, are all protectors of the growth environment that we so know will grow people if they come with the right heart and an ethic and a commitment to grow. Whew, okay, I better stop. A lot of information.